from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. For the Independence Day weekend, we're revisiting some of our favorite interviews from earlier in the year.
I'll get a preview of the upcoming Broadway Across America season.
I'll get my motor running with a look at the Steel Ponies exhibit at the Idle Jar.
And I'll chat with author Dan Barden about his new novel. Plus, there'll be our arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Broadway in Indianapolis has announced its 2012-2013 season, and it includes an interesting mix of old and new school musicals. Travis DiNicola spoke with Leslie Broker, the president of Broadway in Indianapolis, to find out more.
I gotta say, this is a pretty cool season you've got.
You know, it's always, whenever I'm putting together a season, it's always a bit like a jigsaw puzzle. When will the shows be in our neighborhood, mm-hmm. and when will the theaters have the dates available for us to be able to use? So, you know, we start planning a couple of years out at least, and
okay.
so when it comes together like it did, you know, it's one of those, it's like the perfect cake mix.
Well, I was really impressed because, I mean, even though you've got some, you know, sort of more traditional musicals in here, there's an edgier feel to it than perhaps the past few seasons. I mean, you guys always have a great season with Broadway in Indianapolis, bringing these shows here from Broadway Across America. But this season's a little edgy, I think, for...
Well, that's an interesting point that you make. When we were looking at it, of course, with the West Side Story revival, that one was made to be a bit more gritty. It's the brand new production off of Broadway, the revival that just ran. And, you know, they incorporated Spanish language into it, which is, mm-hmm. you know, certainly, you know, obvious and appropriate. But they also, I think, added grit that wouldn't play back in its original day. And so I think it probably feels closer to what was originally envisioned, but perhaps not permissible at the time. So
sure.
I think it's terrific to get that type of production. And of course, you know, that leads me straight into American Idiot, which Green Day's music and the edgy, gritty rock and roll show that just played Broadway. So I think we're very lucky to get it so quick after it just had its run there.
That was the other thing that I noticed about this the 2012-13 season is that really all the shows here are newer shows, more recent shows it seems. I mean, even, you know, as you said, West Side Story is the new version of that. American Idiot, sister act. Jersey Boys was here a couple years ago, but it's great to have back. I mean, that's still, you know, feels very new. And Billy Elliot the musical. So why don't we maybe start at the top, because Billy Elliot's the first one that opens at Old National Center in November. Tell me a bit
sure.
about that one. I mean, a lot of people love the movie. And
well, exactly. You said it. I think that a lot of folks will remember the movie. It's been some time since the movie was out, but when this show hit Broadway, it was destined to be a blockbuster. It's got triple cast kids, because when you have children in shows,
mm-hmm.
they're still doing school and the whole nine yards, so it's a very robust cast, if you will.
Well, I want to stop you there, because I've heard this is an extremely hard show for the boys who play the lead of Billy Elliot, that it's they just have to be so talented and so on it, but it's a really tough show for them to do.
It's a tough show. There are three Billies that will rotate through the show, and it's tough on the producers of the show because Billy can't grow up, and so we're finding that the dancers of that age that have, you know, that level of talent are of an age where they're growing fast. So it's been my understanding that they are casting nonstop because of both
wow.
the rigors of the role and the growth of the kids.
And I think most of the boys that played are usually, what, around 10 years old or so?
I think that it depends. I mean, I think they would rather have a little boy who is more like 13, 14,
okay.
but can play 10.
Got it. Okay.
I think if the younger they can play, the better the older they are, if that makes sense.
Sure, of course.
So yes, it's a fabulous show. Not exactly a family show because it's got some dialogue in it. I mean, it's a tough story about a boy who's going against the grain and wants to be a ballet dancer and not a boxer or some other more you know, traditional male role. So it's wonderful. It took Broadway by storm, no question about it.
And great music from Elton John. So very fun show.
And I think you'll find through this whole season that there's a through line of fabulous composers, and you just hit on the first one.
So tell me about Sister Act, because that one in some ways is a little bit of the odd man out or odd woman out, I suppose, in
exactly.
This year's season. But, of course, a lot of people remember the Whoopi Goldberg film.
And Sister Act is on Broadway now. It's been playing about a year and a half. Great reviews. It's fun. I mean, it stays very, very close to the book or it stays very close to the movie. But the book, I think, propels it forward. The songs have you know, the enthusiasm and excitement that we remember from the great movie. And I mean, it's a hard one to improve upon. But I always think a live experience is the best experience, and this one does it for sure.
Neat. Very good. And then you had mentioned earlier Green Day's American Idiot. That I can't wait to see. I've heard so many interesting things about this. Now, some people may not be familiar with Green Day, a rock band. American Idiot is actually a musical based on their album.
Correct. And I will be one of those who will say, oops, I've aged out of the rock and roll hipster mode, and I didn't know anything about the show. I'm a Tony voter, so I'm very fortunate in that I go to New York each year to preview all the shows, obviously, before we book them. I walked in. I really didn't know the music. I knew one number, but the movement and the staging and the kind of in-your-face message of American Idiot was it grabs you, and it's something that, you know, that I think people relate to at least certain characters within the show. Again, it's got some language that's going to be tough. Mm-hmm. It's got some subject matter that's tough, but it with the music woven through it, it's an entertaining evening that, you know, frankly, we've had a lot of folks asking to see, and I only have the show booked in Indianapolis in this entire region.
Wow.
So if anybody's going to want to see it, Indianapolis is where they're going to have to go.
You know, do me a favor, if you will, because, you know, a lot of people know, you know, Billy Elliot, the story of the kid who wants to be a dancer, Sister Act, the woman who's, you know, on the run as a nun and hiding out. A lot of people may not be familiar with the sort of the basic storyline premise of American Idiot. And even, you know, the title may be a little bit off-putting if you're like, you know, what's that about? So,
well, and honestly, I mean, this, I can tell you the premise, which are our friends who are really questioning where they are in life and where they want to be, and are they secure, you know, living the rest of their lives out in suburbia, or was life supposed to be something more meaningful, and in a post 9/11 world, you know, what exactly is that journey for you? Some folks say the interpretation of the show is one person, so I think there's, you know, sort of a theoretical or philosophical side to this, open to interpretation of what the show's about, to be honest with you.
Okay. Cool. Well, it sounds like it's going to be really interesting. And a lot of people, as you said, are going to want to see this, and it'll be great that Indianapolis is the only place in the region where you can get to see it.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, we've got Jersey Boys coming back, which, Leslie, I got to tell you, when I went to see Jersey Boys originally a couple years back, I did not expect much. I thought, you know, the music's okay. I was never really a big, you know, fan of that style of music and stuff. And I've heard the show's good. I went to see it. I fell in love with that show in the first 5 minutes and just kept on loving it more. And then, you know, went back again and took my parents. And I mean, it is such a phenomenal show.
I think it's one of those. I mean, just like you, I went to see a Saturday matinee in New York. Didn't think, you know, I thought, I'm just going to see Jersey Boys, not exactly my music.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought a single ticket and went back that night because it was, you know, I don't know if it's the way that the guy that wrote the book for that musical, that was his first musical. And for him to be able to take us on this journey, mm-hmm. in some cases a very familiar journey, and for other people, a brand new journey, introducing people to them. The fact that we could all ride that parallel track, if you will, and end up in this place of, I want to see it again, I think, you know, is absolutely fabulous and a testament to why the show has been running as long as it has on Broadway.
Yeah, it's really exciting. It's great that it's coming back because I know a lot of people wanted to see it. The last time was in Indianapolis back in 2010, and it was sold out, I believe, the whole run. So this will give people a chance to see it again, or if they missed it the first time around.
That's right. Tickets were very tight, but it's one of those shows that people want to come back and see. I equate sort of the style of popularity, if you will, to Mamma Mia.
Yeah,
in that it's one that maybe you didn't expect so much, but you go and have fun. And frankly, in Jersey Boys, you learn a lot about those guys. I mean, you may have never understood the story or the bond that Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons had. And when you leave, you've got it down. You know it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, you know, as you do this, you know, putting together the season, Leslie, and you, as you mentioned, you get a chance to see a whole lot of shows and things. And of course, you're looking at, you know, what's the availability of the theaters in town of the shows that are going to be coming around and sort of, you know, putting together almost like a puzzle. But what other things are you looking for in terms of thinking that, you know, Indianapolis audiences want?
We look at it from several different perspectives. Our customers or the people that support the theater tend to either be subscribers or folks who pick their shows one by one and want to come. So the first thing that I'm doing is I'm looking at a package. I don't want a package of shows or a collection of four or five shows that don't complement one another. For example, I don't think you want a season of all revivals.
Mm-hmm.
You also probably don't want a season of all the newest shows from Broadway because perhaps they haven't found their place, and perhaps that's not – people like their comfort zone, I think. So
sure.
I think to put in a West Side Story or a Fiddler on the Roof, you go, you know, it's kind of – it's like a four-course meal. You know exactly what's coming, and you're satisfied at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But then, as you said about
Jersey,
what
to expect. Yep.
You know what to expect. But as you pointed out earlier, with regard to Jersey Boys, I also think the shows that sometimes have the potential to deliver the most wonderful experience to an audience is the unexpected. And for you, that time Jersey Boys was unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
So as I go through here, I know that Sister Act has that sort of unexpected excitement and fun that will come through. Billy Elliot will do the same. So it's looking for a proper mix that delivers surprises and sort of comfort food, if you will.
Travis DiNicola with Leslie Broker, the president of Broadway in Indianapolis. To find out more about the 2012-2013 season, visit BroadwayInIndianapolis.com. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
It is time to get your motor running because motorcycles, symbols of adventure, freedom, individualism, and even danger, have roared into the Idlejorg in an exhibit called Steel Ponies. Why? Sharon Gamble invited curator White Wolf James to tell us how motorcycles are connected to concepts of the American West.
I'm from Northern California. I'm from Mendocino County. My home is 2 hours north of San Francisco.
Mm.
Mendocino County. I'm a Pomo Indian from that area,
mm-hmm.
and I worked at the Grace Hudson Museum in Ukiah, California for many years.
So this was a little bit of a change of scenery, literally.
Yes, quite a big change. I had lived in Omaha, Nebraska when I was in the Air Force, but that was back in the 70s.
And what do you think of the Midwest so far?
You know, Indianapolis is a really beautiful city, and people are really genuine and friendly out here that I've found, and it's no different than any other modern city. It's just getting used to the weather. Of course, where I come from, there's hardly any snow and no humidity, so that's been a little bit to get used to.
Yeah, and unfortunately here we don't have an ocean nearby to help us cool
yeah
off.
I'm not far from the ocean.
I'm from Southern California. I feel your pain. So where did this idea for Steel Ponies come from?
Well, Steel Ponies kind of came about, we had a show here, I think it was 2 years ago, called Dazzling Pistols, Firearms. It was a firearm collection from the Autry Museum.
Right, right.
In Los Angeles, and a lot of presidential guns, Annie Oakley's pistols. And it was so popular, it really brought a whole different cross-section of people into the museum that maybe had never been there before.
Sure.
And so we kind of built on that, and we're always trying to push the envelope on people's ideas about the West or about Native America, because that's what our mission is.
Sure.
And so, you know, because of Pistols and our Jingle Rails holiday train installation we do now, we've had a 40% increase in annual visitations in 2010.
Oh, my gosh.
And last year, 2011, was a record year. And, you know, not only Jingle Rails and Dazzling Firearms, but we did our Red Black show about Native American and African-American connections. And that was really big, and we got a lot of people in for that.
Yeah, cool. So I confess to some ignorance. I've never owned a motorcycle. I've ridden on them, and they're thrilling, and I marvel at the engineering of motorcycles, but I'm not aware of the connection to Native American culture. So let's start there.
Sure. Not only Native American culture, but also the West. You know, Pistols was kind of like a jewelry show, Dazzling Firearms. So we thought, well, let's get some Native American theme bikes and some Western theme bikes and do the same thing. And after talking with a couple other curators, we decided, well, you know, we're about history and culture as well.
Right.
Now, the Guggenheim had done an exhibit a few years back called Art of the Motorcycle, where motorcycles were presented as art. One of the criticisms of that exhibit is it was a little sterile because there were no people involved. And, of course, what good is a motorcycle without a person riding it?
It's like going to a musical instrument exhibit. It's lovely to see a beautiful 400-year-old violin in a plexiglass case, but unless somebody can take it out and play it, you don't have its heart or
right,
its soul.
Right, exactly. So the connection with Native America, this exhibit focuses primarily on Harley-Davidson and Indian motorcycles as the only two companies that survived the 20th century and being uniquely American. Of course, Indian uses a lot of stereotypical images to sell their products.
Sure.
They name motorcycles the Chief, the Scout. They have a Princess Sidecar. And they use all these nomenclatures and imagery. But there are Native people today that even given that, they still like Indian motorcycles.
Mm-hmm.
One of our signature artists for this exhibit is Jim Yellowhawk. He's a ledger artist from South Dakota, and he rides an Indian motorcycle. There's a great picture of him in full regalia on his Indian motorcycle. So there's connections there, but also given the scope of the types of bikes that we have in the show, we're going to have the Saginaw Chippewa bike from the Chippewa tribe in Saginaw, Michigan. It was built by Orange County Choppers on the TV series American Chopper.
Really?
We have another bike called the Great Spirit that's built by a Lakota Sioux man where the tank looks like a full-feathered headdress. And he has deer horn foot pegs and a drum on it. And,
oh, my gosh.
It's really tricked out. And then there's a Native American bike builder in Texas. His name is Danny Sanchez. He's Apache. He's with Cutthroat Customs. And he's building us a board track racer-style motorcycle that will be unveiled at the opening of the exhibit. And I just asked him. I mean, he's doing that without any commission or anything,
and just
to be involved in the project. And then Ben Nighthorse Campbell, retired senator from Colorado. Ben has been inducted into the Motorcycle Hall of Fame for his support of motorcycle riding and safety. He started the Uglies Motorcycle Club with Peter Peter Fonda and Larry Hagman. And he started the Four Corners Motorcycle Rally, which is a local run they do. And we're borrowing a motorcycle from Ben Nighthorse Campbell to be in the show, not only to show Native pride, but also because of his enthusiasm and love for motorcycle riding. So there are some strong Native American connections, especially with Jim Yellowhawk. For your listeners who aren't familiar with ledger art, when Native people were captured in the forts, they gave them pieces of paper to draw on. Sometimes those pieces of paper would be from ledger books, from account ledgers.
Uh-huh.
And they would draw a lot of times ponies themselves on ponies and show their war exploits. Jim Yellowhawk takes that same idea, but he puts Indians on motorcycles, and then he'll have some ponies interspersed, but he uses actual antique ledger paper.
Mm.
And so the opening piece for the show is a Native American in full headdress on a 1948 Indian Roadmaster.
Wow.
And it's on a piece of ledger paper from 1874. And that motorcycle, that 48 Indian, will be the bike as you walk into the exhibit. The opening bike is from the Autry Museum. And it's really the epitome of Western styling and right towards the end of Indians' life as a company. And
which was when?
1953, Indian went belly up. Now, Indian had tried to been... There was people who tried to revive Indian motorcycle.
Yeah.
There was even a tribal group who was going to buy it. Now it's been bought by Polaris. And Polaris makes ATVs and other power sport products.
Motorboats and stuff.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And so Polaris has taken over Indian, and they're going to be coming out with a new line of Indian motorcycles.
So for people who maybe aren't as familiar, what are the basic styles of motorcycles and or riding? You talked about board.
A board track racer, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something for everybody in this exhibit. No matter where your interest lies with motorcycles, and so in the very beginnings, motorcycles were basically bicycles with motors attached to them. The combustion engine had already been developed in Europe, and the first bicycle, if you will, with a motor was developed over there. And here, Indian motorcycle has the claim to fame of being the first motorcycle developed in this country. There was actually one before that called the Orient, but it didn't last long.
Huh.
Indian is started by Handy and Hedstrom, who are both bicycle racers. And they take the bicycle and they put a motor on it, so it's self-propelled. And in 1902, they go into production for the public. So we actually have a 1902 Indian that
really?
We're borrowing from the Museum of American History, Smithsonian Institution.
Cool.
And, of course, to follow up with that, Harley-Davidson says that they were established in 1903. Now, a full production for the public actually occurred in 1905. So we do have a 1905 Harley-Davidson as well with the 1902 Indian, and that's coming from the Harley-Davidson Museum. We have a 1915 Harley-Davidson that was ridden cross-country in 2010 on a cannonball run by Christine Summer Simmons. She's the wife of Doobie Brothers' Pat Simmons, has written a book about women and early motorcycling history, and will be coming out with a book about the cannonball run. She'll be here July 21st to do a talk and a book signing.
That's so
but
cool.
there's vintage bikes. And then we get up into you can see where bikes start becoming more modern looking, like say with the 1936 Harley-Davidson knucklehead, where the tanks, the seats, you know, the motors, the V-twin engine is really developed. And then we take that on up into the 60s, where you start getting custom choppers, and we start looking at movie bikes. So we're actually going to have the Dragon bike that Peter Fonda rode in the movie Wild Angels in 1966.
Ooh.
And the Captain America bike from Easy Rider that he did in 69, the original Captain America bike.
Wow.
But there are major themes in the show. It starts off with the early brands. I do have one other brand of another motorcycle in the show just to show that there were other brands. There were umpteen other brands.
Show the
so
contrast.
We're actually borrowing a 1914 Pierce four-cylinder motorcycle made by the Pierce Arrow Car Company.
Mm-hmm.
They made them for about a year, but they were too expensive. And it's like one of three in existence.
Whoa.
So I'm really, really excited about having that motorcycle here. There's 23 bikes in all. And there's touring. We're looking in 1915... Effie Hotchkiss and her mother, Ava, are the first women to cross the country from the East Coast to West Coast on a motorcycle with her mother, Ava, in a sidecar. So Christine Simmons named her bike Effie in honor of Effie Hotchkiss,
aww,
who made that run in 1915. In 1916, you had the Van Buren sisters, Adeline and Augusta Van Buren, riding cross country on 1916 Indian motorcycles to prove to the government that that women could be dispatch riders for the military because World War I had broken out. And of course that never happens, but it's a great story. And we're actually going to have an actress in the gallery portraying one of the Van Buren sisters.
Cool. What do you ride?
I don't ride right now. I haven't ridden for quite a while. I used to ride a Triumph in the early days when I was younger. And I used to ride a Harley, and then I had friends that had choppers. I had a friend that had a Honda 754 cylinder back in the 70s, and it was the fastest bike in town. But I'm anxious to get another bike now, especially during the run of this show. We have a lot of public programming built around this exhibit. Every Saturday, or not every Saturday, but one Saturday a month through the run of the show, there's going to be a motorcycle rally at Gleaners. You know, the Gleaners Food Bank did a motorcycle rally last year. So we're teamed up with them for their rally this year. That's July 21st. The Miracle Ride that happens for the Riley's Children's Hospital, they've made the Idlejorg Museum a stop on all seven of their runs.
Oh, smart.
To come and see the exhibit, and I think we're offering discount tickets that day. And I'd like to participate in those,
well,
which means I got to get me a motorcycle.
I can tell that, you know, your excitement is more than just that of a curator. I can tell it awakened something in you.
Well, having lived in Northern California above San Francisco, as a child, I did see Hell's Angels. I had been around Hell's Angels from the San Francisco chapter, the Oakland chapter. When Easy Rider came out in 69, I was 13 years old. And it made quite an impact on me and several of my friends. And Steppenwolf Live with the, you know, Born to Be Wild
was
like the first album I ever bought.
And so it was destiny.
Getting that Easy Rider bike here, for me, that was the bike
what
to
a
have.
Coup. Yeah.
Because it's the most iconic bike in America. It's actually been copied more than any other bike.
Hmm.
And the owner of that motorcycle is John Parham with JMP Cycles. He runs a National Motorcycle Museum, and he's also loaned us a Dragon bike. John was in town this weekend, and I didn't get to meet him.
Oh.
He wasn't feeling well, but National Motorcycle was in town. This weekend at the convention center was the big motorcycle dealer expo.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have a table right now, Idlejorg does, at the Boat, RV, and Home Show at the fairgrounds all week, promoting steel ponies, mm-hmm. and then at the end of the weekend is the motorcycle expo. We'll have a table over there, and we're actually going to have a Harley Davidson with a sidecar with the backdrop mural that people can take photos
on.
Oh,
cool.
And that will be in the gallery during the run of the show. We'll have a photo opportunity motorcycle. And we've managed, this is the first time with an exhibit in our special exhibitions gallery, where photography is going to be allowed for personal use.
Ah.
So we've got all the lenders to agree and sign off that people can take pictures.
Oh, that's no small doing in a museum setting.
Really?
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, you know, we wanted to do like a book or something.
Sure.
But we didn't have time, so this allows people to make a record of it. And nobody has ever had this group of motorcycles together. We're also going to have Evel Knievel's bike here.
Ooh.
Yes, the great Evel Knievel. That's also coming from the Smithsonian. And it's the bike that he wrecked on in 75 at Wembley Stadium. And I've been in touch with his artist who painted all his bikes and helmets for him. His name is George Sedlak. And I think George is coming to the opening.
Cool. Cool. Well, have fun as you put the final touches together on this. I hope one of our listeners gives you a call and says, I've got a bike you can ride.
That'd be kind of nice. I was, you know, I'm trying to buy one, but I'm having a little difficulty with that right now.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, if anybody's listening out there and wants to loan me a bike to ride, I'd really appreciate that. But, you know, April 14th is Bike Builders Day. And Danny Sanchez will be here in town. Jim Yellowhawk's going to be here on May 12th with photographer Michael Farabaugh. Michael Farabaugh has just on his own volunteered to do a ride-in motorcycle show for us on July 14th. So local people can come and compete with their bikes with a $2,500 grand prize and a photo shoot for a national magazine.
Wow.
And then we got Motorcycle History Day on June 9th, and we're going to bring in Ed Youngblood, former president and CEO of AMA. It's going to be lots of fun, and I really want to encourage everyone to come out and see steel ponies. If you got a destination to ride to this year, make it the Idlejorg Museum.
That's terrific.
Sharon Gamble with Idle Jorg curator White Wolf James. Steel Ponies is on view at the museum through August 5th. You can see all kinds of motorcycles, from vintage historical examples and famous Hollywood bikes to tricked-out custom jobs, and you can learn how they relate to both the real and imagined American West and Native America. The exhibit features the motorcycle Evel Knievel used in many of his famous jumps, the Captain American bike used in the counterculture classic film Easy Rider, and more than 20 other must-see motorcycles. Find out more and learn about lots of special programming at idlejorg.org.
Here's that calendar. I keep saying that. Here's that calendar thing in 3, 2, 1. Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Something lucky is coming up.
What's that?
On Friday, July 13th, the long-awaited, much-heralded Indie Reads bookstore is opening.
Yay!
With a ribbon. Congratulations to you and your team, your board, your donors, and your community.
I'm nervous about this July 13th thing since it's a Friday.
It's Friday, anyway. But, you know, I think you should just head things off at the pass, borrow a black cat, take it in... Break a mirror in the bookstore.
We were actually talking about doing that. We may do that. We've got a mirror ready.
Okay. Anyway, ribbon cutting. It's open all day. All sorts of things going on. Too much to say on our calendar right now, but you can go to indiereadsbooks.org for more information. Indie Reads Books will be at 911 Mass Ave. So great neighborhood and a great addition to the local scene, especially for literacy.
Thank you. Well, we're very excited about that, and we hope to have lots of events every week that we can even include on that calendar that we call.
What will we do? You're going to have some readings and book signings and all sorts of fun.
That's one of the cool things about the bookstore. There's a stage there, so we can actually have musicians and readings all the time.
I love that.
So the whole calendar schedule will be up on the website. Cool. Hey, do want to mention that coming up in the next week, Indiana Black Expo is starting with their summer celebration starting on July 12th. And it is the largest African-American event in the nation, and it just gets bigger and better each and every year. You can always get more information at indianablackexpo.com.
The last days of Pompeii hold a fascination for a lot of people, and now you can learn more about them by visiting an exhibit in Cincinnati called A Day in Pompeii, the Exhibition. The University of Cincinnati Department of Classics is actually one of the chief programs that is doing research and finding more information about Pompeii. And if you're thinking, I should remember this, but I don't, it's the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 AD, essentially froze a civilization in place. And in this exhibit in Cincinnati, you can see more than 250 priceless artifacts, gold coins, jewelry, marble and bronze statuary, body casts of the volcano's victims, eerily preserved in their final moments. Ooh,
wow.
Creepy. CincyMuseum.org is how to find out more. It's at the Cincinnati Museum Center, which is in that great Art Deco train terminal.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. I used to go to a great pizza place in Pennsylvania called Vesuvio's that
Ooh.
Had a big picture, like a mural of the volcano painted.
Of the people receiving the pizza at their door as the volcano explodes.
As the lava washes over you. Okay, moving on. So, Footlight Musicals, they are opening their 57th season. That's
Whoa.
Amazing right there. With its young adults production of Rent. How cool is that? They open this weekend, and it runs through July 22nd at the Headback Community Theater on North Alabama Street. Performances are at 7:30 on Thursdays, 8 on Friday and Saturdays, and 2:30 for Sunday matinees. Go to footlight.org. That's footlite.org for more information. For Rent at Footlight Musicals, should be a ton of fun. Great musical, and it'll be a great production.
That one's for young performers and presumably young audiences. This next one is not Cabaret, the great Candor and Ebb musical. Bob directs. Bob Harbin
I don't want to
is
see
directing
the
this. No,
I
don't think you do. But anyway, this is opening on July 6th and running various dates through July 21st at the Athenaeum Theater. And it's being positioned as a pretty sassy, sexy interpretation of Cabaret, which is the book and lyrics are pretty sassy and sexy to start with, so can't wait to see what happens. Cabaret at the Athenaeum, bobdirects.com. bobdirects.org for more information.
That should be fun.
Yes. Oh, hey, I'm sorry. Bobdirects.com. I was right the first time.
Hey, real quick, just put this on your calendar. Heartland Actors Shakespeare on the Canal at White River State Park returns in just a few short days with free performances of Othello. They're going to be performing Othello on July 20th and 21st at 8 p.m. and then on the 22nd at 2 p.m. And as in the past years, production takes place right on the White River. It's beautiful. It's free. It's great. Great productions. Shakespeare in the Park. And this should be a lot of fun with powerhouse David Alan Anderson in the title role. Yes. And then also Ryan Artsberger playing Iago. Looking forward to that. Should be very good.
Fantastic.
And we will be back next week with more on that calendar that we call
What do we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Indianapolis author and Butler professor Dan Barden is getting a lot of attention already for his new novel, The Next Right Thing. He's been reviewed favorably in The Atlantic, The Huffington Post, Kirkus, The Pittsburgh Tribune, The Washington Post, and more. Travis DiNicola sat down with Dan to talk about the novel and about Dan's writing process.
Last time that we maybe had you on the air, we were talking about your previous novel about John Wayne, which was a lot of fun. This is sort of a totally different direction, The Next Right Thing. I've heard it described as let me see if I got this right, and then you can respond to it, because this may be totally unfair, but a comedic suspense thriller set in rehab?
Well,
where does that even come from, Dan?
Well, I think that all of those things could be true to a certain extent. The rehab part's not true. It's set in a community of recovering alcoholics in Laguna Beach, California, and most of the major characters are connected to AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, in one way or the other, and pretty much everybody has got some relationship to alcoholism. And the major characters, I'd say the four or five major characters, are all people who have quit drinking and are attending AA meetings, and that's a huge part of their life. And then on top of that is this crime novel. My protagonist is this guy who's has a very checkered and troubled past as a police officer in Santa Ana. He basically got thrown off the police force for excessive violence.
Okay.
And then he gets sober, turns a new leaf with the help of all of his friends. He becomes starts a different career, becomes a home designer, is very successful, and has this wonderful life. And in the middle of this wonderful life, his AA sponsor dies of a heroin overdose, just completely out of the blue, unexpectedly, and basically upsets the apple cart of Randy, my protagonist's life.
And the sponsor who dies, I mean, he'd been clean for years.
He's been clean for 15 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's a big shock, and that's basically the event that gets the crime story moving, because my protagonist Randy decides. Particularly since he has this background as a police officer, he decides he's going to get to the bottom of this and find out what circumstances led his best friend to, just make such a disastrous decision.
Now, I've not had a chance to read this book, and I apologize, but as I'm imagining how this plays out, I would think that, so for Randy, if, I mean, his alcoholism was also tied to his profession as a police officer, and that sense of suspicion and paranoia that's tied to that as well. For him to start pursuing a new case means he's not just, you know, trying to solve this murder, but he's kind of revisiting a lot of the demons that got him there in the first place, right?
There you go.
Okay.
That's my novel. Yeah, no, my novel is basically began with my understanding, my personal understanding as a writer, that almost all the things that make for a good crime novel are bad for your spiritual condition. So you know, to set this guy off on this path of, you know, revenge and trying to understand and trying to get to the bottom of things, and, you know, and
yeah, revenge is not one of the 12 steps.
No, revenge is not one of the 12 steps, and he's very much putting his own peace of mind and life in jeopardy by following this thing into the darkness, and that's where the novel began for me, is in this sense that, like, you know, I'm reading all these stories and I'm watching all these TV shows and I'm, you know, going to all these movies about people who are in situations that I very much don't want to be in.
Yeah.
You know, and that
uh-huh.
any sane person wouldn't want to be in, but it's
but yet
so
we love
much
reading
fun.
About them.
Oh, it's just a blast to read about somebody yeah. who's like, you know, who's so out of balance, you know, mm-hmm. one of the characters in the book says to my protagonist, he says, you know, listen, you know, we have a memorial for the guy. We don't need an investigation, but of course the investigation is the fun part.
Yeah. Now, so you actually, it sounds like from what I'm hearing that you actually approach this from first starting to think about writing a thriller suspense type of novel, and then realized, oh, this is the recovery aspect's going to tie into this? Is that correct? Or did you first want to write about recovery? Because I know that you are a recovering alcoholic, and this is something that's not, that is widely publicized, and it's in fact part of the
yes.
publicity for this book.
Yes.
And so obviously that's, you know, write about what you know. But I mean, which sort of drove this first, wanting to write about recovery or write the thriller situations that people don't want to be in, but love reading about?
Well, they both kind of went hand in hand. I mean, after my last book, which was a very self-consciously literary book, I really wanted to write something that could have a larger audience, that could be more crowd-pleasing. I wanted to, not to put too fine a point on it, I wanted to write a novel that was much more fun.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, and had a lot more twists and turns and you know, and frankly, I was interested in the possibility of violence too, and you know, I wanted to write a crime novel. So I was working really hard on that for many years, and studying certain kinds of novels, particularly crime novels, and really just bearing down on this. And then also on the other side, there was I'd had this experience of recovery. I haven't had a drink in, you know, 26 years. I'm in my family. Not having a drink, you know, for a week, for many of particularly the men in my family is a very big deal. And so this is like a big thing in my life that I'm very interested in, and I really mm-hmm. wanted to write a book about. And so at a certain point, the two desires came together.
Yeah.
I realized one day reading the newspaper that my relationship to I'd had a friend who died under kind of very dark circumstances. He died of a heroin overdose, and it was very hard for me. It was one of the hardest times of my life after he died. And I realized that I could pull that into a crime story and I would have a pretty good book. I mean, I was literally just standing over the newspaper one morning, and I thought, oh my God, I feel about my friend's death the way that a detective might feel about yeah. figuring out what had happened. And so once I got those pieces together, then the two ideas, flowed together, and I had my crime novel, which is what I really wanted, but I also had my novel in which I could investigate this, you know, particularly the way that men interact with each other, mm-hmm. and particularly the way that men love each other, and the way that men care for each other, in a community of recovering alcoholics.
Let me ask you a bit about the studying of mysteries in this part of the process, because I know that, I mean, in addition to being a teacher of writing, you strike me as a great student of writing. I remember when we were talking, oh, probably 10 years ago or so, about writing, and you were telling me how with writers you really liked that you would essentially retype, you know, a chapter or the entire a book into, you know, a typewriter or a computer to really learn the style, the language of writers that you liked. And that really has stuck with me, Dan, and something that I've not typed in a whole novel since then, but I certainly have tried a couple pages because it's a really fascinating exercise. And so what I'm curious about now is, as you approach this and said, okay, I want to write a mystery. I want to learn about what makes, you know, for a great mystery. And of course, you know, within that genre, there's a lot of, you know, sort of boilerplate, you know, type approaches, but there's also a lot of tremendous literature that sort of subverts the idea of a mystery. How did you go about learning the ins and outs and then the ability to improvise from that for mysteries?
Well, I mean, that's precisely what I did. I've followed that course. I typed up for this novel. I typed up The Long Goodbye by Raymond Chandler.
Mm-hmm.
I typed up Looking for Rachel Wallace by Robert B. Parker, which was a favorite detective novel of mine. And I also typed up Fight Club by Chuck Palahniuk, just to throw some hipster spice into the whole thing.
Huh.
And I really had this sense like that if I have mastered these three novels,
yeah,
I can probably that will probably give me the understanding that I need to write the kind of book that I want to write.
May I ask you? I want to interrupt. So when you type up someone else's novel, how long does that process take for? I mean, are you just sort of typing and trying to let it seep in to your unconscious? Are you stopping and analyzing it as you're going along?
Oh, yeah, it's not as bad as it sounds. I mean, I'm always grateful when someone's very impressed by the fact that I typed up The Long Goodbye. But the fact of the matter is that often what I would do is I would type it up for courage. So in other words, when I would start my writing day, you know, whenever my writing day would start, I would type up like two full pages of The Long Goodbye.
Okay.
And one of the things that it did for me is it gave me this sense that it was possible. Okay, these are just English sentences. These are just fairly simple English sentences. I mean, the problem that I think a lot of writers have is that they imagine you're having this very rich reading experience, and you forget that experience is, for the most part, engineered out of fairly common sentences, mm-hmm, and fairly common images. And so part of the thing that I get from typing up these novels is a sense, oh, this is not so hard. I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and you know, particularly with a writer like Chandler, who's so monumental in our culture, particularly among people that read thrillers and hard-boiled detective novels, it's kind of shocking to type him up and say, oh, you know, these are fairly, you know, commonplace sentences. Yes, he's brilliant, but his brilliance is, it accretes over the course of the whole novel.
Yeah,
it's not, you know, anyone can write these sentences, but it takes a genius to write, you know, 400, 500 pages of these sentences, you know?
Okay. It sounds like a great process to go through. So you're not, as you said, within your writing day, you may start with writing a couple pages and then you move into your own work. Is that sort of part of it?
Or? Yeah. So I don't always do that, but, mm-hmm, but particularly when I'm terrified, like I'm starting a new book right now, and this is something that I really depend on as I'm writing this book, because I find when I sit down to write my own book, there's a tremendous amount of anxiety, and it's like, how am I going to do this? Okay, you did it before, but now you can't do it again. You know, you're not this smart, you're not this talented, the story's not that good, and all these ideas start beating me up. And I find that it's very calming. I mean, for example, like with Chandler, it's very calming to type up a page of Chandler and see that this is not a superhuman activity, that this, mm-hmm, is just, you know, piling up sentences. I also, you know, it was also interesting to me, like one of the things that I loved about typing up Robert B. Parker, who was a very good with the larger structure of a novel and could put together these, you know, 200, 300 page books fairly effortlessly. He was so mm-hmm. good at it. And I, typing him up, I would type up chapter, like a 1500 word, 2000 word chapter. And I could go, oh, I see how this works. I see what the dramatic structure of this is. Mm-hmm. I can do this.
Mm-hmm. I'd love listening to describe that process because it makes it seem attainable. It makes it seem like, oh, this is a way of doing it in a way that makes sense for someone who wants to be a writer, who is maybe, you know, struggling with that point of saying, you know, who loves great literature and how do you, start putting something out there to be seen and to be read and to compete with the books that you already love. But to approach it in that way, I think makes an enormous amount of sense.
Well, you know, it brings it down to earth in a way that I think that when you're hearing, you know, college professors and writers and, you know, all literary critics talk about this stuff, it makes it more complicated than it actually is. I mean, it's tremendously complicated, but you know, when I mean, for example, an automobile is an incredibly mysterious thing to me. But if you sit down there and you look at the engine and you look at all the component parts, mm-hmm. it becomes less mysterious.
So can you tell us anything about the next book?
Well, I'm hoping I have a few different ideas that I'm working on, but the one that books that I'm structuring as we speak, I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to pull off in the next 6 months a draft of another Randy novel, what mm-hmm. I call to myself a Randy novel, and I'm hoping that this book will be successful enough that my publisher will be interested in another novel with basically these same characters, because I've just come to love them so much. I'm so enamored with their world that I just would like to stay there.
Travis DiNicola with author Dan Barden. His novel, The Next Right Thing, was just released by Dial Press, and it's available at bookstores everywhere, including his wife's Big Hat Books in Broad Ripple. For more information, visit danbarden.com. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4, when I'll find out more about how the new Wishard is making art a part of the healing process.
I'll talk with Georgia Buchanan about her memoir, 428 and a Half, My Journey Beyond the Railroad Tracks.
And I'll chat with Writers Center Barb Shoup about the new mystery collection that they're publishing. Plus, there'll be our arts calendar we call
What Will We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.